sounds like somebody's running a window screen.
We're live. Welcome to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LP 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And Truth Quest programs are archived at www.gimmesometruth.info. And my guest this evening is James Roger Brown. But before I go there, I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and of my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And so I'll go ahead and get right on in. And well, first, we're going to have a little bit longer program tonight because the first, our regular program, we're going to have James Roger Brown, and then afterwards we're going to have Clint Richardson, and he has some interesting information to add to subjects that we've talked about in the past. But in the meantime, I'm going to say Mr. Brown is a sociology of knowledge specialist and intelligence collection and analysis methodologist. He has developed the only existing objective criteria-based definition of the best interest of the child and serves as a consultant and expert witness in detecting and documenting organized crime methods and procedures integrated. Boy, I grabbed the wrong one that we were going to. You sent me in the bio. I grabbed an old one, I think. And so anyways, but he's expert witness on detecting and documenting organized crime methods and procedures integrated into government child protection agencies and programs. This too. And do you want to add to that, James?
Yes, I, as you stated, a specialist in the sociology of knowledge. That's my overall field. And at the master's level, you have to declare three specializations, and my specializations are the sociology of intelligence operations, cultural reality models, and how other cultures define and relate to the spiritual world. Now, what I'm particularly going to talk about tonight, with apologies to Mama Cass Elliott, will take your listeners to places they've never been before. I know this because most of what I'm going to talk about until 2004 was proprietary trade secret information that my business, the Sociology Center, was based upon. To go back to the beginning of how I got on this path, in basic training, when I was in the United States Army, one day I and one other college graduate were pulled out of the company formation, sent to the Post Theater at Fort Polk, Louisiana, where there were a bunch of gentlemen in civilian suits. They presented to us a program allegedly to recruit White House switchboard operators if we consented to become White House switchboard operators. We would be allowed to wear civilian clothes, given a maximum monetary allowance, off-post housing, the whole nine yards. When it came break time, the gentleman who was heading the speaking stated that after the break, we would have to sign a non-disclosure agreement, and it would tell us what it was really about. At that point, both myself and the other gentleman from my company decided to leave and not come back. When I checked back into the company, the sergeant on the desk, the drill sergeant, in a tone that was intended to raise the hackles on the back of your neck, said, "So you decided not to go to Washington, huh?" And I had a harder life in the military after that, including my M16 misfiring on the firing range, which was potentially an Article 16 offense. When I got out of the military, I had my congressman find out what the heck that was really about. What it was about was Richard Nixon trying to recruit members of the military into an Army unit personally loyal to him. For those who were around at the time, there were rumors that he had designed a Prussian-style military uniform for some type of palace guard equivalent while he was president, which got squashed. I learned from my congressman that after Nixon left office, these people migrated to the Drug Enforcement Agency. And if you remember, when the agency first started, there were all kinds of raids on the wrong farms out in the middle of the country in the Midwest. Well, it was these bozos who consented to join this military unit that were the idiots who conducted that. From that experience, I developed an interest in intelligence operations. And when I switched from majoring in physics for 2 years to
James.
Social sciences, I decided to write my master's thesis as a cross-national study of intelligence operations in World War II.
James, before you go
into that,
James,
yes,
I just want to let you know that, you know, just in, I know that people have been having problems with Skype today, and just in case, you know, if we get dropped, then I'll just go ahead and call you back. But there has been some. I'm hearing a little bit of garbling right now, but I think it's okay for the moment. But that's. I just wanted to give you a heads up. So go ahead.
Okay. Well, I could tell there was some kind of problem, which was why I'm trying to speak more clearly. Mm-hmm. To continue on, I interviewed people from World War II as part of the preparations for doing the analysis of German, Russian, United States, and British intelligence operations. After using qualitative methodology, I'm one of the few sociologists in the country, in addition to the particular specializations, who actually is competent at using qualitative methodology instead of number crunching or quantitative methodology. The two particular conclusions I reached after going through all of the military operations in World War II from the four countries that I mentioned were that the social determinants of success and failure, or the social conditions under which determine whether they succeed or fail, are, first of all, if one intelligence service comes up with some method or technology that is inconceivable to the opposing intelligence service, or, more importantly, if otherwise competing intelligence services had a shared interest in a specific outcome. Now, where you see that coming into play are events like 9/11 and the bombings, the purported terrorist bombings in Britain where the trains blew up. Those could not have occurred without someone in Britain and in the United States wanting them to succeed and actively participating in ensuring their success.
Okay, now, James, one other thing. Can we go ahead and at least, you wanted me to, us to give your email.
Yes, I'm going to do that right now.
Okay.
If you have questions about anything that I'm talking about, you can email me during the show. I will monitor my email. And if you have questions about anything that I'm talking about, I will try to answer them or elaborate. The email address is thesociologist, that's thesociologist, thesociologist at Roadrunner, spelled out, roadrunner.com. thesociologist@roadrunner.com. My website is www.thesociologycenter.com. And that's thesociologycenter.com.
Okay.
And I'm having trouble keeping up because there's a slight echo too.
Okay.
If it gets
any worse, just let me know and then I'll just go ahead and hang up and call you.
Okay. Okay. I think I can cope with it, but I just want to let you know that had cropped up. Now, getting on to what I did after that, when I graduated after going through all the social theory courses and everything, I realized that sociology was nowhere near being a science. So I decided to make it a personal goal to develop a scientific, an actual scientific theory. About that time, I think it was 1996 when the Supreme Court actually made the Daubert ruling. May have been 1992. I don't remember exactly now, but the final theory that I developed was designed to meet the United States Supreme Court standards for science. The innovation that I made was that I looked at how nature handles social processes, and it does it by using neural structures as the unit, and that's what I use for the unit of analysis. Now, as you have life experiences, you acquire skills, and for those to exist, your nervous system has to process the same sensory input the same way every time. So those are neural structures. Those can be described mathematically. And in fact, I developed a way using set mathematics, for those of you who know what that is, to describe social processes. Now, another aspect of what I developed, it's the only sociological theory that has technological applications. That possibility is what led me to interact with Bill Pollack, who your listeners may or may not be aware of. He was a former NSA agent who made a posthumous disclosure of his knowledge about some of the nefarious enterprises. He and I, using the mathematical applications that I developed, went to a national laboratory.
James, before we go any further, I think I'm going to go ahead and call you because it's starting to really get a lot of breaking up. So I'll just go ahead and end this call, and then I'll go ahead and call you right back. Okay. Okay, then let's see if we can put in another disc here and play some music while we get him brought up on the telephone. And so... come on. play.
No more walks in the wood. The trees have all been cut down, and where once they stood, not even a wagon rut appears along the path. Low brush is taking over. No more walks in the wood. This is the aftermath of afternoons in the clover fields, where we once made love, then wandered home together, where the trees arched above.
Okay, I think we've got James back. You there, James?
Yes, I am.
Yes, you sound
much
better.
And things do sound clearer this time.
Yeah, I know that there was other radio programs that only do their work through Skype on the Internet, and they were having a heck of a problem today. And from what I understand, their Skype was having problems. So, anyways, we were talking about Bill Pollack.
Yes, Bill Pollack, also known as William Pollack, was a former NSA agent who made a disclosure video that was released after his death that included disclosures about the chipping technology that's used to chip people. This is human technology and human beings doing it. He also disclosed information about extraterrestrials, which was another area that I was working on, which I'll have to backtrack to bring you up to date on. But when I was interviewing people from the World War II intelligence apparatus, one of them became a personal friend, similar to William Pollack or Bill Pollack, and we had a lot of discussions about the intelligence community, the problems with how intelligence was done, and he indicated that at some point in the future, our intelligence system was going to fail because it was essentially a political process and not based on any kind of actual science. He also communicated to me some information that he was privy to from the World War II era about extraterrestrials operating here in the human environment. One example of which was they had a persistent problem that had developed with bombing missions to Germany being off by a consistent number of degrees when they relied on magnetic compass readings for locating and dropping bombs on the target. When they tracked down what the problem was, there was alien technology that was distorting the Earth's magnetic field and producing the distorted bombing runs that were off target. This gentleman asked me to do two things, somewhat in exchange for the information he provided to me. One was to see what I could do about developing a better intelligence collection and analysis system, and the other was to ascertain what the extraterrestrials were doing here. This occurred in the 1978 time frame, and for a few years after that, our conversations. So while I was working on the sociological theory, I was also simultaneously trying to solve a problem of how to develop a new and more effective intelligence collection and analysis system or set of methods and procedures. I was also working on ascertaining what the extraterrestrials were doing. Now, I worked on this until 1994, before I had some kind of closure. What developed was a case of genuine convergence. I discovered that all three of the problems had the same solution, which was what I had developed in the theory, that if you used neural structures as your unit of analysis and the mathematical processes by which they operated, you could collect and analyze intelligence. And when I analyzed the accounts of, for example, abductees, plus some other anomalies that later appeared on places like Google Earth, Google Maps. In Florida, there was one example where this huge globe or sphere was obviously floating above Florida. There's actually a grid of those around the entire planet, which are normally cloaked, but like all technology, then it breaks down from time to time, and if you happen to be looking in the right direction, you can see something that you weren't supposed to be able to see. Anyway, I developed the intelligence collection and analysis methodology, and also worked on what the extraterrestrials were doing here.
Now, before you go,
Mr. Pollack and I, okay. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you're going there. Go ahead.
Okay. Bill Pollack and I went to a national laboratory. I actually formally engaged in a contract with him to do this. Not many people are aware of it, but national science labs have programs where a business can go to them with an idea for building something totally new, and they will use their purportedly advanced expertise at problem solving to develop prototypes. Well, we tried to get them to develop a prototype for neural scanning technology, which I had identified the technical specifications for from looking at extraterrestrial intelligence operations here and how they were collecting information from abductees by scanning their neural structures in response to specific stimuli. But the national laboratory that we approached to do this decided that they could not build it. There are two reasons. We did not have at the time and still currently do not have the means to make the scanning, non-destructive scanning of the central nervous system at a fine enough resolution to collect the data. The second problem is the massive amount of data that would be produced by such a neural scan of a complete human being's brain and spinal cord. We do not have the sufficient data storage capacity at a convenient level yet to do that. So even though it's more than 10 years since we tried, I've been following the technology, and we are still not at the necessary scanning resolution, and especially non-destructive scanning resolution that the extraterrestrials apparently have.
James,
do you think
that possibly, now this is the stuff that they're releasing to the public, but you don't believe that they even would have a black ops project where they could?
Now, the intelligence community technology is only about 20 years ahead of what's available commercially. Now, there are black projects that are reverse engineering alien technology, and they're probably way ahead, but those are in the hands of more or less rogue and private operations that are outside of government structure. And I'll get into explaining why later, but these are some of the more evil people. One of the things, I actually wrote a commentary in support of Bill Pollack's release, in which I indicated that these people, part of what he disclosed was that private funding was going into these black projects, that they were a mixture of government tax revenue and private wealth going in to fund these black projects. The reason there's private wealth going into them has to do with why the extraterrestrials are here. And it basically is to deal with some of the more nefarious and black-souled people that are here. And the reason they're putting their private wealth into these black technology projects is they want to develop technology to protect themselves when the extraterrestrials try to implement the protocols for why they're here. This may get a little tricky and step on some people's toes, but basically we normal people like Melody and I and probably most of your listeners.
I don't know if I'm normal or not. But
you know, the people, the evil, and there are genuinely people. One of the things that I discovered from the intelligence community is that there are people out there who choose to follow Satan just like Christians choose to follow God. And these people are evil. Their intent is evil. And I'll have to get into why a little later. But
now,
evil people have caused them problems on the worlds where they live.
Okay, now, before you get too far down the road from Bill Pollack, now, Bill Pollack, did he kind of die a little bit mysteriously, or was there something?
Well, he developed cancer. His death wasn't as mysterious as one of his associates who was, rammed with a vehicle and killed in a traffic accident by somebody who disappeared that had false identification. Basically, he was clearly assassinated.
And what were they working on?
There's technology called Rife technology that could have saved Bill and any number of other cancer patients, but the information for using it properly was destroyed back in the 20s when Royal Rife was shut down. For those of you who don't understand what that's about, basically everything has a resonance frequency. And what Royal Rife developed was a radio transmitter that could be tuned. And he had identified the resonance frequency for hundreds of organisms and various types of cells, including cancer. Now, if we had been able to identify the resonance frequency of the particular type of cancer that Bill had, theoretically, we could have, tuned the equipment to the proper frequency and killed all of them. But we never found the resonance frequency in time to save him. Neither I nor his widow believe personally that this was other than his time to go. But it is, a possibility that something occurred that we weren't aware of. That's always one of the possibilities. As I stated, one of the two conditions under which intelligence operations succeed are somebody developing something that's inconceivable. So it's possible that somebody developed some inconceivable, some method that neither I nor his widow could think of or knew to check for that would have detected its presence.
Now, was this a fast, very fast acting cancer? No.
I wouldn't call it fast acting.
Okay. And then was he working on anything particular that might have been?
Now, he had been out of the in the private sector for some time. He left NSA and started his own business, and in fact had several businesses at one point, including developing some new energy technology. But
okay, the only reason
I'm not aware of anything other than what he and I were working on that would have got him into trouble.
Okay, well, I'm just asking that because a lot of times that is a lot of...
Yes, and it is a good question and something should be kept in mind all the time when you're talking about people that aren't with the program. You know, I learned that from my experience in the military, which has been a major character builder for me because telling them no and surviving the aftermath gave me the strength to tell them no on subsequent occasions. And I can give you an example. After my, and this is also a good example of how closely these people monitor and control information. Within 2 weeks of my master's thesis being put on the library shelf at Memphis State University, I was sitting on a bench in front of the library one day. A gentleman came up and sat down next to me and said, "You know, you're Roger Brown, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." And you wrote your master's thesis on World War II intelligence operations? I said, "Yes." He continued his conversation, informed me that he worked for the CIA, wanted me to come to work for them, and if I refused, I'd be dead within 2 weeks. Not from lack of trying did that occur, but I told them no. And that experience and some subsequent ones gave me my survival skills.
Okay, and I'm talking to James Roger Brown, and his website is www.thesociologycenter.com, and he's speaking on his you're best off at describing what you're speaking about.
Now, let me put this in context. You know, this is not what I spend my life doing. I've actually developed applications for the intelligence methodology for civilian use, such as analyzing evidence in criminal cases. I've actually appeared as an expert witness in cases. I specialize in analyzing the evidence and developed ways to find the truth, including an innovative methodology called paired contradictory hypothesis testing that fixes the high error rate in police methodology, which use contrary hypothesis testing, which has an extremely high error rate. That's why they're constantly having to release people from prison that have been there for years. So, you know, talking about extraterrestrials and, nefarious intelligence dealings is not what I do most of the time.
And we do have a prior interview.
This is a rare interview that I do only on rare occasions when I'm dealing with somebody who has some grasp of what I've done. And William Pollack was one of the few people who understood, especially the mathematics behind what I had developed, basically because it integrates some methods and procedures that the extraterrestrials use, that this is about 800 to 1,200 years ahead of current social theory, methodology, and including about that far ahead of the methodology used by the intelligence community. The intelligence community relies on contrary hypothesis testing, too, which is one of the reasons they have a high error rate, too. But if you switch to contradictory hypothesis testing, you can reduce your error rate to close to zero. And as evidence of that, all of the cases in which I did the evidence analysis and the case went to trial and resulted in not guilty verdicts. And most of the other cases that I did the evidence in, they dropped the prosecution.
Now, have you done?
Saw where it was headed.
Have you done a lot of these?
Yeah, I worked on doing that from. I started my business in 1996, and worked on that until 2006. Actually, I've worked on two cases since 2006. I moved to Kentucky to take care of my parents, who were in their 80s at the time. Now my mother is 90, my father is deceased, and I'm taking care of her and occasionally helping out in some false child abuse allegation cases.
Now, we did do a program on that sort of thing.
Yes, we did.
And it is in the archives on...
And if you want, if your listeners want to obtain some more information, they can go to my website, which is www.thesociologycenter.com. Once you get there, there's several places you can go. I'll try and indicate the highlights, especially if somebody is there. You will want to go to the publication shopping cart page, where you can actually purchase a copy of the Holographic Paradigm Theory of the Structure and Function of Social Processes, which is a formal theory that's a set of a sequence of propositions of fact that, if true, you know, reach certain conclusions and incorporate how to mathematically describe social processes. There's also a section on interspecies intelligence collection and analysis methodology. One of the properties of this theory, because it's based on neural structures, is that it can be applied to any species with a central nervous system, whether it's terrestrial or extraterrestrial. Special research projects. There are several links down at the bottom. The Child Slave Trade Project is where I have all the information on organized crime and organized science fraud in the child protection, mental health, and social work systems. And you can download the entire congressional evidence book I wrote on that topic, which documents things like how the MMPI-2 is rigged to produce false positives. There's another page, Organized Crime and Fraud in Science, the occurrence of interspecies cooperation, unexplained missing persons project, government catastrophic natural disaster plans, classified archaeology, anthropology, and social research project. In the late 1940s, there was a classified United States Navy report analyzing the evidence, the archaeological evidence of prior civilizations on the North American continent. I know that this report exists, but but I have not been able to get my hands on a physical copy of it. There's also a section on suppressed science, which some of you may be interested in. And again, that's under the link Special Research Project. Under consultant services, if you want to consider getting my using my professional services for some reason, analyzing evidence in a criminal case or other things, you can download a copy of my contract there. Most interest might be the Internet bibliography page. I've used the intelligence analysis methodology to write political analysis and commentary for about 20 years now. The Internet bibliography contains links to all of those except the two most recent ones that I've written. There's also a link to my curriculum vitae. What was the question you had?
Oh, you wrote one that's called The Essential Skills of Critical Thinking. Now, is that up there?
Yes. On the publication shopping cart, you can review descriptions of the holographic paradigm theory of the structure and function of social processes, the Concise Family Defense Manual, which is something I worked on with some attorneys that converts corporate proactive legal defense strategies to proactive family defense legal strategies. For example, in the false child abuse allegation situation, there are things and that are model forms and stuff in this that you can use to make it more difficult for the organized crime and science fraud to come after your family. And, of course, the holographic paradigm theory of the structure and function of social processes, pseudoscience and pseudologic and psychological testing, which is now incorporated into the Congressional Evidence Book.
Well, one of the things you were talking about a little bit earlier was on this analysis, and that you were saying that, you know, the psychologist used one form and you had developed another method for coming to the truth, and that you'd used this in some legal situations, and you'd had, like, I don't know if you want to relate the incidents with the person who'd come to you that, you know.
Oh, yes. Yeah, let me go over two things. I'll get to that here. The Sociology Center Practical Guide to the Essential Skills of Critical Thinking, that's a book that provides detailed instructions in an organized way on how to identify logical fallacies, and it's geared toward showing a student how to analyze something they have to write or read, or how to construct a logical argument in something that they have to write. And the last one, which you're talking about, is the Sociological Center Practical Guide to Identifying the Best Interest of the Child Using a Criteria-Based Definition for Judges, Prosecutors, Child Abuse Investigators, and Law Enforcement, a Disciplined Approach to Finding the Truth Under Circumstances of Charlatanism, Deception, and Evidence Falsification. That's basically an adaptation of some of the intelligence methodology I developed specifically for analyzing evidence in a child abuse allegation. And what Melody was making reference to is I told her that I sorted out the innocent and guilty before I ever agreed to work on their cases by telling everyone who came into my office that I used objective methodology, and if they were guilty, I would find out, and if I found that out, I would testify to that on the witness stand. And I had people who get up, leave, and I never darkened my door again. And I think that's one of the reasons why all of the cases in you know, which I did the evidence analysis that went to trial, they were not guilty verdicts.
So in other words, your process is pretty self-evident to the jury.
Yeah, it's, you know, what I do is design ways to find the truth, whether it's intelligence analysis methodology or applications in law enforcement. Or could be for any other circumstance that someone might have that they needed some way to find out the truth, you know, for some situation they were dealing with. They could come to me and I would help them design ways to find out the truth when people were lying and falsifying evidence.
So this ties over into your work with what you were doing with Bill Pollack?
Yes.
Okay.
You know, I was using, as I developed methodology, I used it for the problems I was trying to solve, including what the extraterrestrials were doing here. And, you know, when you look at some of the things they were doing, well, I had mentioned to you the Tunguska incident in which mainstream science has come up with various and sundry explanations, from exploding comets to black holes. As best I can determine from the eyewitness accounts, an object came into the area and was following a straight course and then suddenly changed course and shortly after that exploded. Now, there were other eyewitnesses who saw another object enter the area. From the physical evidence and from what I've been able to ascertain about what the extraterrestrials are doing here, this is basically a plague planet with an equivalent of a quarantine. And somebody was trying to break quarantine. They were coming in for a landing, probably in the Americas, and someone launched a device that had antimatter in it to take them out. And antimatter explosions would leave a particular type of residue that does not occur naturally. And one of the things that was discovered in the Tunguska area was this residue. So my assessment was that somebody was breaking quarantine or trying to, and they got shot down.
Okay, now where do you come up with this, this information to come up with this kind of an assessment?
Well, you know, there's only a limited number of reasons why somebody would suddenly change course and, in trying to evade something that's coming into the area, and, you know, subsequently there's an explosion that's clearly nuclear from the debris field, you know, the tree fall pattern and some of the other things that were there. Plus,
but we're talking about what time in history we're talking about?
The Tunguska explosion, I think, was 1918, 1917. It was the early 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to World War One.
Well, then, 1918, 17, that's not prior, though, is it?
No, I guess not. Sorry about that, but it was in that time frame. There are other aspects of information I've gotten from various and sundry sources. One of which was obtaining some information from an individual who had worked at a facility that under which there was an exchange of industrial capacity for I'll say, really foreign technology. People over the course of time have told me various and sundry things, which I incorporated into the insights I developed. Plus, you know, you can look at some of the anomalies, both lunar, Mars, and here on Earth. I think I mentioned some of the Google anomalies here on Earth, where there are, you know, the cloaking technology, if you can think of it as that, breaks down and something becomes visible. There was also the case of a drug interdiction jet with infrared technology spotting something that was hanging in the air, and then when it realized it was spotted, it began an evasive pattern. There was also an incident in Amsterdam, I think, where a Dutch police helicopter spotted something on infrared and followed it across the city. There are, you know, any number of situations like that occur that provide insights on how they're collecting intelligence. Bill Pollack told me about one source in the Forestry Service who told him that he and another person, was surveying an area and saw two extraterrestrials placing a long canister in a position which would have, if it were an antenna array or something, covered a major city that was in the area. So, you know, they're obviously collecting intelligence in a number of ways, you know, from these accounts and others that I've been made privy to, plus some of the things that I, was told about operations in World War II. I think a lot of people know about the Foo Fighters. So far, I haven't gotten any questions.
I've worked on that one myself. I don't know how many we get on that. But when you say,
let me remind everyone that it's the sociologist at roadrunner.com. Send me an email if you have any questions about what I'm talking about, and I'll see if I can answer them. When was the other gentleman going to be coming on to?
It won't be for another hour. So.
Oh, okay. I thought he was going to be coming on momentarily.
No. And I thought it's Tunguska event is the one.
Yeah, Tunguska.
Okay, right. All right.
Going back to the.
And that was 1908, by the way.
1908, yes. The theory went through several development stages. The first statement, and keep in mind that I started working on this in 1978. The first formal statement was in October of 1994. I made some, added some additional insights in 1995. The third statement was September of 1998. And the fourth statement was November 2000. The fifth statement was October 2001. And the sixth and last evolution was August 2004, which is when I took it from being proprietary trade secret information and made part of it public. I still have held out the exact technical specifications for constructing the neural scanning technology. And the reason I have done so on that is because there are some rather horrific weapons technology applications, and I do not want to be responsible for turning loose down on the world with no control for it.
Now, is there some health? I mean, I would foresee that there possibly would be some kind of a health application with this too, or am I wrong?
Yes, there would be health applications. You know, it'd be a powerful diagnostic tool for, you know, certain types of neurological function disorders. It would also be a powerful testing tool. You know, one of the reasons for testing people is to find out if they've learned what they are supposed to or what is desired that they learn. If you actually could go in and check the neural structure that developed from, you know, what they were trying to be taught, you could actually ascertain the degree to which they had successfully incorporated that specific skill. One of the applications that we had intended on applying it to was for airport security. If, for example, you knew the neural structures that were associated with specific terrorist skills, say, for example, the location or the set of neural structures on how to get to a specific camp, you know, just some set of neural structures that would be unique to terrorists or somebody trained to construct a bomb, you could scan for the presence or absence of those in people passing through an airport. Once you detected, you know, a suspected skill, you could pull that person out of the line for further evaluation, and you wouldn't have to have the current system we have now, you know, crotch checks and other debasing, just totally unnecessary stupidity.
Now,
there are more effective ways of doing this.
Okay, now, with the current system of going through the scanners, which is questionable on the amount of radiation you're exposed to, would this be, have that same?
Well, that's what I emphasized earlier, why I emphasized earlier, the importance of developing non-destructive scanning technology, because you don't want something that would, you know, destroy the central nervous system, because, you know, once you've destroyed it, it's kind of pointless to try and apply it to the individual. One of the things, however, the power that you can develop from this, say, for example, in anthropology, you wanted to preserve the language of a tribe in South America or Africa that's disappearing, you know, you would map the neural structures and have the neural structures in an electronic form that you could then use in a computer to reproduce the language.
Okay.
Or any other set of skills.
Okay, let me go ahead and say that this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And I'm going to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and of my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And my guest this evening is James Roger Brown, and I'm going to let him take it from there.
Okay. Well, would you like to cover any particular area? I can go into more detail on how the theory works. Some of the applications.
Well, I mean, the way I met was introduced to you was through, you know, doing a radio program with Dave Hodges, who I had on KHN, and his partner on his program is was the spouse of Bill Pollack, correct?
Yes, the widow, okay. Annie DeRizzo.
Right, and so you, being that you were listening to the program, and that was where I had become acquainted with you conversing, or I'm not quite sure how, but anyways, that's where we had met up. And working, I mean, Bill Pollack, I'd viewed some of the videos on YouTube several times, and he was part of the, they included him. He did an interview with Stephen Greer on for the Disclosure Project.
Yeah, he was part of the Disclosure Project.
And so, but you were, well aware of him before the Disclosure Project, right?
Yeah. As I said, we, and actually there were several other individuals that I worked with in conjunction with Bill. I won't go into the details on it, but he left behind something of longer duration and importance than his video. He actually organized something that is a process that's ongoing and hopefully will have an effect on changing the outcome of events that are occurring between now and 2012.
Interesting.
That's one thing I cannot discuss because of all of the people who participated in this and are doing what they're doing, signed non-disclosure agreements not to reveal the identity of any of the other persons participating. So we had, insights about some of which were derived from the work I had done and some from the work of others about what was going to be coming, and especially the intent of the extraterrestrials and what they're here to accomplish. And as I said, it's to deal with the inconveniences that have been caused to them over a substantial amount of time, apparently. It actually took them some time to, using probably some really amazing technology and other methods, various spiritual skills, to track down the source of where this plague of consciousness was coming from, and determining that it was here. And, the force and technology and the number of individuals and craft that have been sent here to deal with this are extremely substantial. And it includes more than one party, shall we say. There's one that's the equivalent of the Federation. It's an amalgamation of different species that have found common interest in ending, getting us out of their pain. One is a single species which is probably the most ancient and long-running civilization that's out there. I'm talking billions of years old. Probably one of the first ones that formed after them. Existence got org enough to produce intelligent species. And the other, the third party that's here, you already know about. Who do you know that sent folks here, one person in particular, to deal with the evil here?
You're talking about
God.
God, okay.
God and Jesus. You know, amazingly enough, they're all here because of the same thing. That was one of the mind-blowing insights that I had. You know, when I looked at what they were, trying to accomplish, it's kind of like the methodology I used for identifying the criminals operating in the child protection system. When I looked at what was being accomplished, it was clear that there was a political ideology being pursued through the contracts and other things that were operating, you know, by which the child protection system was operating. And I identified the political entities that were responsible for it. They actually refer to themselves as female supremacists, lesbian separatists, and lesbian avengers. And they began organizing in a series of social work programs in the 70s.
Okay. Now, this goes back to some of the stuff that we covered in that first interview,
yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yes. The organized crime, it's essentially a union of these political anti-family and anti-male political extremists and regular white-collar criminals. And I'm just using that as an example of how this methodology can be used in different
to identify it.
Yeah, in different situations to identify intent in what's being conducted. So using the same methodology in reverse engineering what the extraterrestrials were doing here, it became obvious that they were all here for the same reason.
Okay, now where were you getting your information to make this analysis?
Well, like I said, I started by analyzing the accounts of abductees.
Okay.
You know, that was a major, it was an early major source of information.
Now, was Bill working with you on this part here?
This I developed before I met Bill.
Okay.
I met Bill probably about the time of the third
update, or
yeah, the third revision of the statement.
Okay.
Actually, may have been later. I met him when he and another person he works with were on the Art Bell Show. Yeah, I called in. Well, I didn't call in. I actually contacted him after the show and, shared with him what I had developed up to that point, and especially about we started talking about the extraterrestrial intelligence operations that I had, the state of knowledge I developed about them at that time. And, he had began to appreciate, the significance of what I had accomplished in, mathematically describing social processes and developing an entirely new system for conducting intelligence operations.
Okay, so were you guys able to get through what you were really trying to accomplish before he passed, or?
The organized effort that I vaguely referred to. Probably, yes.
Okay.
The other stuff that I'm working on, you know, I was working on a lot of things separate from him. We had some convergence of interests, and in those areas we did work together. But as I said, most of my effort has been at dealing with organized crime and organized science fraud in the child protection system in particular, and in other government programs and entities.
Okay, now,
for example, I've actually filed, based on what I've done, I've filed a deceptive trade practices complaint with the Federal Trade Commission regarding the intentional rigging of psychological tests to produce false positives.
Okay.
They haven't done anything about it, but I have, using what I developed, filed such a complaint. I've also filed it at several appropriate points in the state government here in Kentucky, and developed a program or set of strategies for people in other states to use to try and get their attorney general to do something about this, because it is a violation of consumer code that's on the book in several states. So, that's what I was focusing on at the time, and I did not discuss in the media, such things as what I'm talking about tonight, because it would have adversely affected
that
or could have, right, by standing as an expert witness, in testifying in cases.
Now,
but I'm doing it now because we are running out of time. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the Mayans used to reach their conclusions, but as I pointed out to you in our private conversations, when you look at all of the government reports and warnings that are scattered around the country, from New Orleans warning about the levees before they broke, and I gave you an example of Arkansas being warned in the late 40s that they needed to build a statewide system of reservoirs to avoid depleting their groundwater. They did nothing. There are reports like that all over the country and around the world that, people know this problem exists and they've done nothing about it. And those are, I call it a perfect storm of stupidity, human stupidity. And that is going to be hitting around the end of 2012.
Okay,
so, the Mayans had the timing right. Whether it was for the same reasons I'm aware of or not, I do not know.
Okay, now one of the things you were telling me earlier, too, is that, I mean, we get a lot of disinformation out there. I mean, layers and layers and layers of it. That's part of the problem of having, why I do what I do. But you were telling me something like seven layers thick.
Yeah, all intelligence operations that are classified, it's part of the methods and procedures that they use for all of them, that they develop at least seven layers of cover stories, and for some of the really ugly ones, I've been told that they have 10 levels of cover stories. And using the Roswell example, there was recently a book put out by a woman who claimed that a single source told her that what actually crashed in Roswell was some kind of Soviet psych op using deformed 13-year-old Russian children and putting this craft and crashing it in the United States to scare the bejesus out of. That's probably about the fifth level of cover story for what happened in Roswell. And, one of the things that happens when you put out all these cover stories, once one gets knocked down and somebody puts out another one, You know, by the time you get to the truth, people are so confused, they don't know what to believe.
So your work,
which is the intent.
So your work, can it just kind of cut through a lot of that?
Yeah, to some extent. You know, I did, well, the information that I told you about the project exchanging industrial capacity for weapons technology, that came from being in the right place at the right time.
And you might elaborate on that a little bit, if you want.
It would adversely affect somebody who's still alive and
all right.
could be identified if I provided too much information about how I obtained it.
Okay.
So I will say some about it, but not enough to get this person harmed. But it's a project that normally has total security. And there are a number of operations. You know, some of the black operations that Bill Pollack talked about have total security. What that means is nobody leaves alive or with their memory intact about what they worked on or what they did. I guess it would not hurt to say how I the individual sought out my help for reversing what was done to them after, you know, when they left, so that they did not have a gap in their memory.
Okay. So, in other words, there's ways and means of the government protecting the secrecy of their projects. And,
yes.
And it can...
you either kill everybody or do brain wipes.
And what... Have you run into these people with brain wipes? Is that what you're...
Well, this was one particular individual who, because of some people we knew in common, got directed to me.
Okay. But have you been around anybody that has had these brain wipes or told
That's
they're going to have?
That's the only one that I know of.
Okay. So, but you are aware of the process or?
Yes. There's actually probably material out there. I think I vaguely remember, you know, some descriptions or partial descriptions from time to time, you know, where it's a combination of drugs and stress, sleep deprivation, you know, things like that that go on for extended periods of time that, you know, could be, I think it would take at least 2 weeks to a month to do this.
Okay, now.
And, you know, ensure that it's gone. One of the things by which this could be accomplished, you know, you mentioned earlier that there were people who had technology that could tell whether somebody was lying or not. You know, you can observe someone's brain using you know, thermal imaging or some other system to monitor the blood flow and determine whether or not they can remember something.
Could you reverse engineer?
This would be some kind of feedback mechanism where you could determine when somebody could no longer recover a memory.
Okay, now I'm going to be airing that, I believe, on it. I think it's the...
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
I said, I think I'm going to be airing the program on, I believe, the 21st of this month on the person that you're referring to who does the, can do the frequency diagnosis and which can tie into looking at sound and or hearing sound or having various processes that analyze sound so that they can tell whether somebody is telling the truth or not, let alone what's going on with their body physically. But I'm wondering, with what your work does, if you had somebody that, you know, say like had a brain, their brain was wiped or whatever, I hear about, in some of the programming that I've heard they do to some of these children sex, those that have been programmed and traumatized and the like, that sometimes that wears off. And so I'm just wondering if maybe you can reverse engineer with some of the work that you're doing. Does that mean?
Well, there's two other sets of skills that I have. I'll remind you that the other areas I specialized in were cultural reality models and how other cultures define and relate to the spiritual world. In those areas, I did a lot of research in extension of Joseph Campbell, who studied world myths and concluded that they were all attempts to describe the same spiritual world. What I did was look at what other cultures define as teachable and learnable spiritual skills. I acquired a number of skills by learning from other cultural sources what they define as spiritual skills. Some of them were from martial arts, such as Aikido. I also studied for several months under a Tibetan healer, and some of those skills were what I used in assisting the individual in what he was trying to accomplish in recovering. So that's a different set of skills. Another aspect of it is there may be paper trails that can jog memories. Say, for example, if someone went on leave while they were, say someone was working at a place for 2 years, okay, and they left the facility at various times for, you know, whatever reason, went to conferences, visited relatives, bought gas, bought groceries. So, you know, the information might be in their credit record, receipt drawers, you know, that might have been missed in the cleanup, so that you could say, you know, you were here on such and such a date. You know, here's what you got at that time and place. What can you recall about it? So there's various techniques that you can use to help somebody recover the gaps or fill in the gaps. Physical and metaphysical, I guess you could say. I'm heavily into being practical. One of the people who developed the atomic bomb, I was asked what kind of science he used or something, and or what kind of science he believed in. His response was, "I believe in whatever works." I'm kind of in that school of thought.
Okay, so as far as, I mean, I know I keep coming back to Bill, but I
don't mind that, because he is a very important figure. You know, he was in a unique situation. You know, literally in the case of the chip technology, he is the one who took it from, you know, obscurity, and although it was not his intention, put it in the hands of these evil people. You know, his intent was honorable, and he was a good man. He was about as good a man as you could possibly be and work in those situations and still be alive. His intent in bringing this technology to someone's attention was to deal with a situation where we were having people disappear, you know, from our intelligence apparatus and friendly governments. For example, I think one of them was the Italian prime minister was kidnapped, and you know, 2 weeks later he comes back and somebody's drained everything he knew out of him. And with this tracking technology, the key people could have been tagged and then tracked whenever they disappeared. And that's what his intent was for bringing the, you know, that technology from where he found it to where it could have been used for that purpose. Unfortunately, some of the evil people, you know, working on these black projects, no doubt using some of the technology and stuff that they developed in the black projects, penetrated what he was doing and diverted it to their malicious purposes.
Now, when you say, you know, if people want to look him up on the internet, it's Pawlec, William Pollack.
Yeah, it's, I think it's under Bill Pollack, Bill Pawlec. Now, the spelling is unusual enough that if you do a Google search for it, it turns up because there's probably hundreds of sites out there referring to him now. But it is on, the video is on the, I think, YouTube section for the Disclosure Project, and it's at other places too.
Okay. Now, another aspect you get into in your work is your, and I'm not sure how to ask this question, but it has something to do with the dimensions, I don't know if you can take it from where I'm going with this or not.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
This is important for people to understand. People talk about there being parallel dimensions and whatnot. One of the things that I did, and it's documented in the theory book, if people want to purchase it, they can order it from the website. But there's an entire section on the physics of consciousness. And for consciousness to work and us have connection to the spiritual world, everything that was originally one still has to be connected. If there were parallel universes, our consciousness would not work the way it does. People would not have near-death experiences. And one of the things that I documented, both from, you know, insight from looking at other cultures and personal experimentation, is that prior to what we refer to as the Big Bang, there were, I'm on the high end, physicists know that there are at least 9 dimensions or properties of existence, and possibly as many as 26. I'm in the school of thought that it's 26 or somewhere in that vicinity. But people get confused from science fiction where when they talk about dimensions, their concept is of a whole world with, you know, things moving through the air and all that stuff, but dimensions are just properties of existence, like length, width, height, and duration. There are specific properties of existence, and as I described to you, there's a way you can conceive of how this would work that's less complex than contemplating, you know, high and low energy band of domains, which is what happened when the Big Bang. We're in a set of properties of existence that are length, width, height, duration, that's in a low energy domain, and the rest of them are at higher than light energy. But they're still connected, and that's why we, when people have near-death experiences or when we die, you have the experience of going through a tunnel. There actually is one connecting the high and low energy domains. It's a point, but it's basically a tunnel of a type. But if you can think of or visualize 26 bar graphs, okay, and on one end you've got a set that represents, you know, bar graph that represents length, one that represents width, height, and time or duration, okay, and they're in the low energy domain, so you can you know, highlight them as blue or something, and the rest of them are red. But if you have a cube, okay, that's 2 inches on a side, then there would be, you know, 2 units marked off on the bar graph for length, 2 on width, 2 on height, and then, you know, whatever amount of time the cube existed, you know, would be represented as something greater than zero on the duration bar graph. And the rest of them you would not know, or either would be set at zero. And if you, again, compare a square to the cube, say you've got a square that's 2 inches long and 2 inches wide, then you would still have 2 inches on the length, 2 on the width, but the height would be zero. So you would only have positive values on the 2 of the bar graphs. Well, we don't know the names of the other, you know, other bar graphs that constitute the whole 26, if that's the correct number. But we may be able to determine whether or not they have a value greater than zero or not. But you know, the important thing is that you can, it's easier for you can conceive of 26 bar graphs that represent the individual properties of existence of the total set than trying to contemplate things, you know, occurring in simultaneously with, you know, with components in the high energy domain and the low energy domain. But for consciousness to work the way it does, there has to be something going on in both the high energy and low energy.
Because it's done by frequency, right?
And I'm sorry?
Because it's done by frequency, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and so one's going to be higher and lower, I mean, in its wave.
You know, what the Buddhist monks do is, and these are learned skills, you know, you raise your energy level, and if you raise your energy level, you can become aware of more properties of existence. I don't know if anyone's managed to achieve awareness of all 26, but through concentration, you can learn them. And there's a simple example from martial arts. In a traditional Asian dojo, the individual, to get the black belt, has to pass a test in which has to defend himself against 5 other opponents while he is blindfolded. Okay? So the only way for him to fight off these 5 individuals is if he has become aware of their energy and can follow their energy as it moves around him. And there's actually a set of basic skills that you start learning. One of them that is the first one that you learn as a process for getting to this point if you take your hands and put them about 3 inches apart, like you're going to clap them, and then move them back and forth, don't let them touch, do it several times, you can begin to feel a push and pull, a slight tugging sensation as you move your hands back and forth. Well, the question from that is, how are you able to feel them? Because your skin isn't coming into contact, so it's not, physical, the sense of physical touch. Well, what the Buddhist monks know is that you actually have 12 senses. And, this is just one of them that you haven't constructed neural structures for processing the information. And by doing these exercises, you begin to develop the neural structures for processing this as sensory input. And when you get to the point of, going through all of the learning exercises they have, you can pass the test for your black belt. Now, that's in a traditional Asian dojo. What passes for, martial arts training in the United States, in most cases, leave out the spiritual component, and it's more or less form without content. And for an Aikido practitioner, they have to learn how to build the energy field around them in a book called The Llewellyn Guide to Psychic Self-Defense. I think it was around during the 60s and 70s. There's an exercise called the Tower of Light. That's the easiest one. That explanation is the easiest one I've run across for Western minds to understand. But it teaches you how to start building the energy field around your body. So those things, are out there, but you've got to find them. And, it's kind of a personal opinion, but I think that's where the church failed. If the account in the New Testament is correct, Jesus taught his disciples all of the skills that he had acquired from whatever source, and their instructions were to teach everybody else how to do it. If that had been carried out, then today you would be able to go to your minister and tell him you wanted to learn, and he'd be able to teach you. But that's not what happened. At some point, the religious leaders decided to become political powers, and to do that, you had to have people dependent on you, and so they didn't want to teach anybody these methods that would allow them to become spiritually aware on their own. So, at some point, things got corrupted, and you can't learn them from any convenient source. You've got to go out and do like I and others have, of going to other cultures and learning these techniques. And it's all the same thing. You've got to build the neural structures from your own personal experiences to be able to use these. What I know and what you hear me saying is of absolutely no value to you unless you have the personal experiences through learning or whatever that allows you to build the neural structures for implementing these skills. That's what I always told my students when I was teaching sociology. What I know and can do is of absolutely no value to you. You've got to have your own experiences and learn it yourself. It's sad but true. It's the only way. People talk about being able to take pills and learn things. If that ever happens, it might be great, but somehow I don't think that's in the cards. You've got to get in there and do the work to build the neural structures or you won't get it.
Now, one of the other things that you'd written was the essential skills of critical thinking.
Yes, that's a book specifically geared for students. When I was teaching, one of the situations I dealt with was students coming in who could not write coherent sentences, let alone coherent paragraphs or constructing a paper that, was a coherent argument to going from some beginning to reach a conclusion. To compensate for that, I took something that I'd been given as a handout in college and started developing a set of instructions for identifying logical fallacies. And, what I built was a set of procedures by which you could use these to go through some story or book or whatever you had to analyze and make sense of it. For example, there are three types of propositions: propositions of value, fact, and policy. Proposition of fact is, something is something exists or something is true. Proposition of value is that something is desirable or undesirable, and a proposition of policy is that you should do X, Y, or Z. You should do some specific thing for some reason. And what you find in how people manipulate other people is they will put forth propositions of value or policy, wrongly identified as propositions of fact. You find a lot of televangelists using that technique. But what this does is allow you to go through and analyze and see where this is being done so that it makes it more difficult to fool you and deceive you, using these techniques. And, it incorporates all of this in a structure that, you can go step by step in either analyzing something or writing your own paper, term paper, book, whatever you have to do. And that was, grew out of the need for the students that were coming into a class from high school that had never been taught these skills. And it's, I hate to get on a soapbox about this, but, dumbing down is real. These people were result of generations of dumbing down because the teachers didn't have the skills themselves. And I created a fictitious guru from southern India named Baba Ram Dass. One of his sayings is, you can't teach a dog to hunt if you don't know how.
So... I've done some interviews along the lines of the educational system, and so this critical thinking is useful for just about anybody then, for isolating and figuring, thinking through these logic processes of logic, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, your listeners may be interested in, as I said, I've written a lot of political analysis and commentary that's unlike anybody else. One of the things I wrote was, and this got me castigated not only in regular media, but the science sector as well, the importance of disciplined violence to civilization. And I go through the history, brief history of how, organized violence went from, pre-civilization where, individuals, was either fight or flight, to the point where, organization developed, villages formed, and people had to make the transition as they, became attached to specific pieces of land and had to defend it. You had to develop the skills from the hunting skills to, you know, the skills you needed to defend an area. And those, the first forms of organized military units were called sacred hunt societies, you know, where hunters got together and, you know, compared skills and whatnot and, you know, practiced a kind of religion. That was the early beginnings of what became military armies. And there are three types of killers that grew out of that. I call them savages, soldiers, and warriors. Savages kill for emotional satisfaction of some kind. Soldiers follow a military code of conduct. And as I point out in the article, you know, that at times in history that has been a minimalist philosophy, but it has existed. Warriors incorporate a spiritual component and only kill when it's the best solution or only solution that's consistent with divine will as the desirable outcome for a situation. You know, this is where you get into the level of, you know, warrior monks who, you know, the highest form they can achieve is to disarm their opponent and leave them alive. The highest level of that type of philosophy was Aikido, which was the last martial art developed, and it incorporates techniques from all the others, and integrates Christian philosophy in the form of you have the right to defend yourself, but you should not add to other people's stupidity by killing or harming them. So yeah. Aikido has no attack. It's all about directing the energy of attack away from you or around you, controlling it. And the highest practitioner of Aikido avoids conflict by detecting when someone thinks of attacking them and diverts that thought away from them so that there's never actually any physical confrontation at all.
So I just forgot what I was going to ask you, sir.
Now, the answer is 12.
The answer is 12, huh? Well, so I wanted to find out why you got so much flack over that.
The subtitle on it is why most feminists are savages. The sociologists were upset because I was, arguing that violence had some constructive role in civilization, because they're all, you know, kind of liberal leaning, and you gotta understand, you know, my personal passion is finding out the truth. And one of the reasons why my work is not better known is you'd be surprised at how few people there are out there who actually are interested in finding the truth. A lot of people who say that they want to find out the truth are in fact just looking for ways to confirm, one bias or another. And, you know, here I am as a sociologist writing about the role of violence in civilization as a, you know, as an essential component. And, that definitely goes against grain of sociologists who, think that violence is undesirable or bad. Violence probably is undesirable, but it exists and does have a function as an important part of our history and ongoing social processes. And you can look today and see savages, soldiers, and warriors that exist in the world. You know, a lot of the atrocities and stuff in the Middle East and Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, even United States soldiers, you know, have killed for emotional satisfaction. You may recall the soldiers who were prosecuted for raping a Muslim girl and then killing her entire family to cover it up. You know, those were savages. You also have soldiers who, you know, who do try and adhere to the, you know, some military code of conduct, and in the form of, in our civilization, it's supposed to be the Geneva Accords for, you know, how we're supposed to conduct warfare. You also have people that you know, openly discuss having violated those, and I would do so again. You know, so people who are in the military can actually migrate in, you know, one situation to another between savages and soldiers. And warriors, genuine warriors, are really hard to find in modern armies. They still primarily exist in, you know, like Buddhist monasteries.
But they're not really training them, are they?
People don't realize it, but there was a warrior monk tradition in the Catholic Church for quite a while. And that was part of the process of shutting down spiritual awareness skills. You know, they literally shut down all of the warrior monk monasteries and as part of, you know, converting from religious responsibilities to becoming a world political power.
But they're not really training for warriors anymore, right?
Now, militaries probably have never trained warriors. Warriors get out and find their own, you know, training. You know, they seek out spiritually oriented, you know, martial arts places. To some extent, that's what I did. You know, I went and looked at specific skills in ninjutsu, aikido. You know, I studied Tibetan healing techniques, and I've used all of them to some extent, one time or another, keeping my body and soul together.
Well,
because I have encountered hostility. I've done things in the past that have offended some really nasty people. I used to help protect missionaries in the field, and in one case I discovered and kept I discovered a plot to assassinate a missionary. And the folks who were planning on doing that, when the missionary didn't go where they planned on hitting him, they came after me.
Now, is this? I mean, they had to have suspected it beforehand, or were you? How were you involved in something like this? What was other events taking place?
Well, in this particular incident, it was the situation was this: the people who were responsible for planning this viewed themselves as the spiritual guardians of traditional religion in a certain area, and they had previously killed a Catholic monk who was trying to accomplish something similar to what this Baptist missionary was. And It was before I came along, and he was successfully assassinated. It's kind of, you know, again, some delicate area because I don't want to get people into difficulty who are still alive. So I can talk about that to some extent. You know, I did do things like that in the past, and it did upset some folks.
Okay, now this is in the line of the work that in study that you've done, and that's how you got involved in this, or does this have to do with something else?
Well, after I finished my master's thesis, there were people that came to me hoping for solutions to certain problems. And one of my motives for developing something that actually worked is, you know, these people were asking me to do things that could get people killed. And I had to develop something that actually worked. And, you know, the current sociological theory at the time couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was part of the motivation I had for, you know, developing a theory that actually was based on reality and how the world actually worked.
Okay, now is this something that's on your website?
Well, you can tell that by looking at the holographic paradigm theory of the structure and function of social processes. You know, it's a series of logical arguments, and it's in the form of an actual statement of a theory which most people have never seen. You know, social theory that's out there is not stated as a formal theory. It's, you know, in a lot of cases just rambling thoughts that are poorly organized and nothing approaching an actual, you know, formal theory. But, you know, I set out in the beginning to avoid those weaknesses. And, you know, I've had people who've criticized what I've written, like the article on, you know, the role of violence in civilization, but nobody's ever attacked the theory, tried to disprove it, in part, I think, because they can't. Okay. I've done a good job on constructing it, and I actually, after I finished it, the first statement, I spent an entire year going back through the entire thing looking for logical flaws or mathematical errors, and didn't find any. And once I'd done that, I used it to set up my business and treat it as a proprietary trade secret information because it was
Now we're at a close here. We got to bring it to an end. And
I'm sorry. Boy, time flies when you're having fun.
Andrew
Brown, the sociologist at Roadrunner.com. My phone number is 606-836-1139. The website is www.thesociologycenter.com. And
again, and I want to thank you, James, and this will be, again, archived at www.givemesometruth.info if anybody wants to reference back to this. And I want to, again, thank you.
I thank you for having me on, and so does Bubba Ramdas.
Okay. All right. Have a good evening.
Bye.
Bye.